Sister Outsider remains one of the most influential feminist texts ever published, with luminaries from bell hooks to Roxane Gay citing it as transformative to their thinking. When Beyoncé sampled Lorde's words in her 2016 visual album Lemonade, it introduced a new generation to this revolutionary Black lesbian feminist's work. The collection has been translated into 17 languages and appears on countless essential reading lists across disciplines. What makes this slim volume of essays so enduring? Perhaps it's Lorde's unflinching examination of how power operates through our differences, race, gender, sexuality, class, and her insistence that acknowledging these differences, rather than ignoring them, is our path to collective liberation. As she famously declared, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. In these pages, Lorde invites us to reimagine what true freedom might look like if we dared to embrace our whole selves. For Audre Lorde, poetry was never a luxury, but a vital necessity for survival and change. She understood that the quality of light by which we examine our lives directly impacts what we create and the changes we hope to bring about. Poetry serves as illumination, giving name to ideas that were previously formless but already felt deep within us. Women, especially Black women, have historically been denied access to traditional forms of power. Yet Lorde recognized that within us lie deep, dark, ancient places holding reserves of creativity and knowledge that European modes of problem-solving cannot access. These hidden sources represent true knowledge, not just intellectual understanding, but embodied wisdom that integrates feeling with thought. "I feel, therefore I can be free," whispers the Black mother poet in response to Descartes' "I think, therefore I am." This radical reframing challenges the Western privileging of rationality over emotion, suggesting that our feelings, when honestly explored, become sanctuaries for our most revolutionary ideas and meaningful actions. After facing possible breast cancer and confronting her mortality, Lorde realized her greatest regret was her silences. This harsh clarity showed her that silence offers no protection. Your silence will not protect you. She survived through the strength of women, Black and white, old and young, of various sexualities, all waging war against the forces that would silence them. For Black women especially, visibility brings vulnerability, but also strength. When we transform silence into language and action, we begin to define ourselves rather than being defined by others. This self-definition is crucial to liberation. If we do not define ourselves for ourselves, we will be defined by others. The development of self-defined Black women is vital not just to women's liberation, but to Black liberation as a whole. Lorde challenges us. What are the words you do not yet have? What do you need to say? She acknowledges the fear in transforming silence into language and action, but insists we must learn to work and speak when afraid, just as we work when tired, for the weight of silence will eventually choke us. Our differences don't immobilize us, silence does. The erotic represents a profound resource within each woman, rooted in unexpressed feelings on a deeply female and spiritual plane. Every system of oppression must corrupt these sources of power to maintain control. For women, this has meant the suppression of the erotic as a source of power and information. We've been taught to suspect this resource, which has been both vilified and superficially encouraged as a sign of female inferiority. The false belief emerges that women can only be strong by suppressing the erotic, but this strength is merely modeled after male power. The erotic offers replenishing force to women who don't fear its revelation. Often misnamed by men as pornography, the erotic is actually the measure between our sense of self and our strongest feelings. Having experienced this depth, we require no less of ourselves. The erotic becomes a conscious decision in all endeavors, work, creativity, relationships. In systems valuing profit over human need, work is robbed of erotic value. The erotic forms the bridge between spiritual and political realms, providing the power that comes from deeply sharing any pursuit with another person. It functions as a reminder of our capacity for joy, demanding that all of life be lived with this knowledge. When we live from within outward, guided by erotic knowledge, we become responsible to ourselves in the deepest sense. In touch with the erotic, we become less willing to accept powerlessness or states not native to us, resignation, despair, self-effacement. The erotic charge is not easily shared by women operating under exclusively European-American male traditions. But women-identified women are increasingly brave enough to risk sharing this electrical charge without looking away. Recognizing the power of the erotic gives us energy to pursue genuine change rather than merely accepting character shifts in the same weary drama. This understanding transforms how we approach everything in our lives, from our most intimate relationships to our political activism. When we tap into this wellspring of power, we begin to understand that joy itself is a form of resistance in a world that would prefer us numb and compliant. Much of Western European history conditions us to see human differences through a lens of binary opposition: dominant, subordinate, good, bad, superior, inferior, us, them. This simplistic framework permeates our institutions, education systems, and social structures. In our profit-driven society, this systematic categorization creates and maintains groups of surplus people: black and third world people, working class people, older people, and women, who become marginalized and exploited for economic gain. Institutionalized rejection of difference serves a profit economy that requires outsiders as surplus labor and scapegoats. This system perpetuates itself through three main mechanisms. Those in power learn to ignore difference, those seeking power learn to imitate the dominant group, and those who are subordinated learn to hate and destroy both themselves and others like them. We have developed sophisticated tools for maintaining hierarchies, but possess few patterns for relating across differences as equals. This deficit manifests in our workplaces, educational institutions, and social interactions. The genuine differences between us, race, age, sex, class, physical ability, aren't inherently what separate us. Rather, it's our collective refusal to recognize these differences and examine the distortions that arise from our misconceptions about them. Racism, sexism, ageism, heterosexism, elitism, classism, the work of extracting these distortions while reclaiming and celebrating our differences is lifelong and requires constant vigilance and self-examination. In American society, the mythical norm, white, thin, male, young, heterosexual, Christian, financially secure, holds both visible and invisible power. Those who fall outside this norm often identify one particular difference as their primary source of oppression, while remaining blind to other forms of oppression they might perpetuate themselves. Within the women's movement, white women frequently focus exclusively on gender oppression while ignoring or minimizing crucial differences in race, sexuality, class, and age. The pretense of a homogeneous sisterhood masks deep divisions and inequalities. Lord specifically confronts the painful exclusion of black women's experiences from white feminist work through her powerful open letter to Mary Daly. She challenges Daly's narrow focus on white, Western European, and Judeo-Christian goddess images, pointing out the glaring omission of powerful African deities like Afrikaite, Yemanje, Oyo, and Mawulisa. The absence of the warrior goddesses of Vodun and the Dahomian Amazons represents more than oversight. It perpetuates historical erasure. When Daly does reference non-European women, they appear solely as victims, effectively distorting history by eliminating the rich legacy of black foremothers who wielded power and influence. The practice of using black women's words only to introduce discussions of their victimization, such as in chapters on African genital mutilation, represents a form of intellectual colonization. This approach ghettoizes women of color's knowledge and experience, reducing complex histories and cultures to simplified narratives that fit within a patriarchal Western European framework. Our collective future survival depends on developing new ways of relating within equality. We must learn to recognize and respect differences among women as equals, using these differences to enrich our visions and strengthen our struggles. The old patterns of dominance and subordination condemn us to endless repetitions of oppression. While change inevitably means growth, and growth can be painful, it represents our only path forward. Embracing our differences, rather than merely tolerating them, opens new possibilities for our collective survival and transformation. The absence of diverse perspectives fundamentally weakens any feminist discussion, creating blind spots that undermine the movement's effectiveness. Academic feminism often operates from a position of privileged myopia, assuming it can theorize about universal female experience without examining crucial differences in class, race, sexuality, and cultural background. This intellectual arrogance particularly excludes the vital insights of poor women, Black and Third World women, and lesbians, perspectives that could radically reshape feminist discourse. When the tools of racist patriarchy are used to examine its own fruits, the analysis becomes inherently limited. These tools, including traditional academic language, methodologies, and frameworks, were designed to maintain existing power structures, not dismantle them. The absence of lesbian consciousness or Third World women's perspectives creates more than just gaps. It perpetuates systemic erasure. Women's natural inclination toward nurturing relationships and building connections represents not pathology, but revolutionary potential, precisely what patriarchal systems fear and work to suppress. Difference must be recognized as more than something to merely tolerate. It is the essential catalyst for creativity and transformation. The dynamic tension between different perspectives, when approached with mutual respect and equality, generates new possibilities for understanding and change. True liberation requires community, but not at the cost of homogenization. The strength of any movement lies in its ability to maintain unity while celebrating and leveraging its internal diversity. For women who exist outside society's narrow definition of acceptability, survival isn't an academic exercise, it's daily practice. It requires developing strategies to stand firm in the face of disapproval, building alliances across difference, and creating alternative support systems. The master's tools, whether they be traditional academic discourse, hierarchical organization, or competitive individualism, cannot fundamentally transform the systems they were designed to maintain. They might allow for temporary victories within existing structures, but cannot create genuine systemic change. In academic feminist spaces, the exclusion of women of color is often dismissed with claims of ignorance. We didn't know who to ask. This same excuse perpetuates the exclusion of Black women's art from galleries and their writings from curricula. The burden shouldn't fall on women of color to educate white women about their existence and experiences. This draining dynamic merely reproduces racist patriarchal patterns of labor exploitation. Lord challenges each individual to confront their deep-seated fears of difference, examining how these fears manifest in their choices and actions. This personal examination becomes political action when it informs how we structure organizations, build coalitions, and make decisions about inclusion and representation. This framework extends beyond feminist theory to all liberation movements. The civil rights struggles of the 1960s demonstrated that oppression operates on multiple levels. External systems of discrimination interact with internalized oppression in complex ways. Too often, marginalized groups direct their anger horizontally at each other rather than vertically at systems of power. The concept of political correctness sometimes became another form of constraint, as movements forgot that unity requires neither uniformity nor unanimous agreement on all issues. Racism is the belief in one race's inherent superiority and right to dominance. Lord's anger responds to racist attitudes and actions. If your dealings with other women reflect those attitudes, then anger and fears can become spotlights for growth, not for guilt. Guilt and defensiveness serve none of our futures. Every woman has a well-stocked arsenal of anger potentially useful against oppression. Focused with precision, anger becomes a powerful source of energy serving progress and change, not a simple switch of positions, but a radical alteration of underlying assumptions. Anger expressed and translated into action clarifies who our allies are and who our genuine enemies are. Lord witnessed countless examples of white women's failure to engage with racism, demanding she soften her tone, claiming to understand black women better after minimal interaction, avoiding responsibility by claiming no women of color attended their events, wanting her to process their anger for them, preferring to discuss only comfortable childhood memories rather than painful racist realities. For black women, anger has an even more complex dimension when directed at other black women. Every black woman in America lives somewhere along a curve of ancient, unexpressed angers. This anger stems from a three-pronged iceberg of hatred, that societal death wish directed against us from birth for being black and female in America. We absorb this hatred as children and often fail to recognize how it functions, its echoes returning as cruelty in our dealings with each other. The anger between black women is particularly devastating, born from desperation and shared pain. We recognize each other, yet cannot meet each other's eyes. We've metabolized hatred like daily bread, surviving the constant assault of racism until anger becomes our fuel. Yet this anger, while clarifying our differences, cannot create our future. It can only demolish the past. Despite a rich history of connection and mutual care from the Amazon legions of Dahomey to the Sisterhood of the Good Death in Brazil, black women struggle to realize genuine sisterhood. We avoid each other's gaze, fearing betrayal or recognition, having absorbed so much loathing that our cells have learned to live on it. We've survived by turning hatred into protective fury, but this comes at the cost of our connection to each other. Black mothers face the impossible task of preparing children for a world that will try to destroy them. When black women lose our mothers, we lose the one person who truly saw us. Little black girls, taught by hate to despise themselves for not being white or male, cut our eyes at sisters who reflect our worthlessness, while our mothers alone recognized our value. If we could give ourselves the acceptance we expect only from our mothers, we might see each other clearly. Instead, we approach each other with harshness, with voices of predetermined annihilation, attacking what we most desire to love. We've adapted to hatred by becoming stone, now bruising ourselves upon each other. With white women, black women can maintain relationships at a middle depth, emotionally limited but sustainable, except in rare cases built on mutual commitment to hard work and confrontation. Between black women, however, we face an unexplored tangle of needs and furies regardless of context, whether as colleagues, activists, or lovers. We maintain artificial distances, refusing to examine our differences for creative exchange. We come to each other coded in stereotypes, fearing judgment. Am I black enough? Too black? As black women, defined as never good enough, we try to overcome by excelling, becoming different from what they say we are. Our self-rejection remains our guilty secret, hidden under expensive makeup and hair straighteners. Political work alone won't save our souls, though without it, we can't survive to effect change. Self-empowerment is the most difficult political work. When we don't name the confusion between sisters, we act it out destructively, never speaking from old pain. We can break this inherited cycle by mothering ourselves, establishing authority over our own definition, affirming our worth through commitment to our survival and that of other black women, recognizing our successes while being tender with our failures. Mothering ourselves means learning to love what we've created through definition, being both kind and demanding with ourselves. As we fear each other less and value each other more, we'll balance recognition in each other's eyes with our own self-perception. Self-love goes beyond surface appreciation of Black beauty to a deeper empowerment. We must consciously practice tenderness toward each other until it becomes habitual, since what was natural has been stolen, the love of Black women for each other. By being gentle with each other, we learn gentleness with ourselves. Raising Black children in a racist, sexist society presents unique challenges that demand extraordinary wisdom and courage from parents. The task requires teaching children to simultaneously embrace self-love while developing resistance to systemic oppression, a delicate balance that can mean the difference between survival and destruction. Lord articulates her deepest wish, to raise a Black man who can withstand the corrupting influences of power, who understands that his righteous anger should be directed at oppressive systems rather than turning inward against himself or outward against women. For Black children to survive and thrive, they must become warriors equipped with keen awareness of oppression's multifaceted nature. This awareness extends beyond recognizing overt racism to understanding subtle institutional biases and microaggressions. When her 8-year-old son Jonathan faced bullying at school, Lord found herself at a crucial parenting crossroads. Her initial impulse was to tell him to fight back physically, a common but problematic response that reinforces the dangerous notion that might equals right. Instead, she chose a more nuanced approach, sharing her own childhood experiences with fear and persecution, demonstrating that true strength lies in understanding and responding thoughtfully rather than in domination. The most powerful lesson she strives to impart is authenticity, the courage to listen to and follow one's inner truth despite external pressures to conform. This was powerfully illustrated when 12-year-old Jonathan matter-of-factly corrected a friend who kept referring to Frances as the maid, simply stating that Frances was my mother's lover. This moment demonstrated his comfort with his family's identity and his ability to stand in his truth without shame or hesitation. As both a Black woman and lesbian mother, Lord grapples with complex questions about separatism and community. She acknowledges her need for women-only spaces and Black-only spaces, while recognizing she cannot and will not abandon her male child to navigate the killing streets alone. The presence of her son in her life keeps her theoretical positions honest and grounded in reality. She's grateful for this challenge to any rigid ideological stance. Now 14, Jonathan has been raised in an environment where power dynamics are consistently examined and discussed during regular family meetings. The non-sexist relationship modeled by his parents has profoundly shaped his worldview. When questioned about growing up with lesbian parents, he identified the greatest advantage as his enhanced ability to understand people and his freedom from traditional gender-based prejudices. Notably, he cited that the main challenge wasn't personal discomfort, but rather dealing with ridicule from other kids, specifically those outside his immediate peer group who know better. Through their parenting, Lord and Frances have provided Jonathan more than just love and support. They've offered a living example of how to navigate relationships with honesty, mutual respect, and continuous dialogue. This model extends beyond romantic partnerships to encompass all human connections, providing him with tools for authentic relating in a complex world. Their approach demonstrates how conscious parenting can help children develop both resilience and empathy, essential qualities for creating positive change in society. Revolution isn't a one-time event, but requires constant vigilance for opportunities to make genuine change in established responses. We must address each other's differences with respect. The 60s should teach us not to lie to ourselves. Freedom cannot belong to any group without others also being free. We cannot wait for charismatic leaders while our communities suffer. Each of us must find our work and do it. Militancy means actively working for change without guarantee of success, doing the unromantic work of building meaningful coalitions between whole, self-actualized humans. In the university, you'll be courted with tokenism and individual solutions. But remember, a black woman attorney driving a Mercedes is still subject to racism and sexism. We don't need to be identical to fight alongside each other, but we must recognize our sameness while allowing our differences. We must identify the despair oppression plants within us and fight that voice telling us change is impossible. We cannot afford to destroy each other. That only serves our enemies. Lord's experience in Grenada illustrates how easily liberation movements can be crushed when we don't stand together. Under Maurice Bishop's People's Revolutionary Government, Grenada transformed. Roads were improved, bus service established, free healthcare and education provided. Unemployment dropped from 40% to 14%. When the U.S. invaded in October 1983, they found pretexts to justify destroying this progress. America's ready acceptance of the invasion reflects a moral fiber weakened by racism, the dehumanization of black people making it easier to accept the rape of a tiny black nation. The Pentagon, eager for a winnable fight after Vietnam, diverted the American public from domestic problems with this military action. This example shows why we must learn from history rather than repeating its mistakes. We lose our history too easily when it's not pre-digested by mainstream media. Perhaps we don't listen to our poets, our fools, or the maternal wisdom within ourselves. Each of us forms a link between anti-poor legislation, gay shootings, synagogue burnings, street harassment, attacks on women, and violence against black people. We must examine how our daily lives contribute to others' subjugation. Survival isn't theoretical. We must consider who labors for our bread, assembles our electronics, or creates nuclear waste that won't biodegrade for millennia. As we face these challenges, Lord reminds us that our differences are our strength when we learn to use them creatively rather than destructively. By embracing our whole selves, anger, eroticism, vulnerability, and power, we begin the work of genuine transformation, not just for ourselves, but for our world.